You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
This is Brian Callen and my colleague Hunter Motz, and this is The Brian Callen Show. And let me go through my dates before I bring we talk about our lovely guest. I'm going to be at Donnie B's. Donnie B's, ladies and gentlemen, in Springfield, Illinois, the 4th and the 5th. I think it's even, the 4th and the 5th. No idea what that club's like. They're just paying me a lot, and I'm excited. And then October 11th and 12th and 13th, I'm going to be at the Houston Improv. And then October 17th, 18th, 19th, I'm going to be at Helium in Buffalo. Can't wait to be in Buffalo in October. Woohoo! Gray, snow. It's going to be amazing. Can't wait to get drunk. And then Calgary, Alberta. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Enough about me. We got Karen Carbo on the line. Karen, I love your writing. I love how you get to the point. And I want to say something. Women are always a mystery. You guys are a mystery. But if you want to learn about women, I would say it's a fair thing to say that reading your book, especially Julia Child Rules or any of the Coco Chanel, you focus on these powerful women. And it's, you know, when you hear that as a guy, you're like, I don't want to read about Coco Chanel and fashion. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with people who chose to live on their own terms.
Exactly.
And distill and get to the essence of what it is to live a life, a meaningful and full life. And
Brian, you got it. You have it all.
There it is. And that's the end. That's the end of the end of the interview, ladies and gentlemen. We did it.
Brian, you peaked in the first few minutes.
I sure did.
You've never done that before, have you?
But I've also read your blogs, Karen. I love the way you just get to the bottom of it. You're just a straight shooter and honest about it, and it's very refreshing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I try.
Why Coco Chanel? Why Julia Child? Why these women?
You know, I mean, there's sort of the you know, prime time answer, and then there's the real answer. So,
I like the real answer. See,
you know, I mean, the real answer is somewhat sad. The prime time answer, I'll do that really quickly.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've written these four what I call kick-ass women books. The first was Katharine Hepburn,
yep.
Coco Chanel, Georgia O'Keeffe, and now Julia Child.
Right.
What attracts me to these women is, as you said, you know, and really whether they were male or female, they lived life to the fullest. They lived to great old age. They had second acts and third acts and fourth acts, and they just kept going, and they did. They lived life completely on their own terms. And they also changed 20th century culture. Mm. So those were the sort of things that really attracted me to them. But, you know, on a kind of, you know, more somber note, my mother died when I was young,
mm-hmm.
and I think one of the great things that attracted me to them is they were all became very old bags, old opinionated bags, and I sort of never had that in my life. So that's kind of the deep psychological reason.
That's really interesting. And so as they got older, they became shadows of themselves. Hubris took over and things. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. It's actually what happened is most of them kind of faded from view a little bit, and then when they were like really old, they had these comebacks.
Yeah.
They had comebacks. I mean, you know, Julia actually did not become. I mean, when she started on The French Chef, she was 50 years old.
I didn't know that. I knew she was middle-aged, and I knew. I love the way you describe how the guerrilla tactics, how they started this whole thing.
Oh,
with the dad,
with
her husband doing the dishes, and they'd bring their own stuff before dawn. I mean, it's great.
Yeah, they paid for the food, and sometimes after the show, they would auction off what they had made to help defer expenses.
That's what's interesting is I don't think Julia Child had any idea she was going to be an American icon.
No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all. And that's another thing that I think, you know, for all of us kind of living in contemporary times is that, you know, she lived her life from the inside out.
Right.
I think so many of us, you know, we are so kind of inundated with everything that's on the outside, and we try and sort of adapt to you know, what's coming at us instead of generating what's inside of us.
Well, you know, as you're saying that, I was thinking about the phenomenon that is Kim Kardashian, or even Lady Gaga, who I don't think would be as popular if it wasn't for her innovative costumes and sort of the spectacle. It's not so much about her music, and for that matter, even Madonna. And
right.
And I wonder how you, what context you put those things in, those women in, because I think there's nothing interesting to me about Kim Kardashian, and here's why. She's never accomplished anything.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big mystery why we continue to be a, I mean, I could understand sort of a one-off, like here's this crazy chick that did this thing, but we seem to have this enduring fascination, and I don't understand the how it endures.
I don't either. I guess it's the equivalent of watching pornography, maybe, or
celeb,
you know,
porn.
Yeah, something like that, or maybe it's just.
Well, I think the other thing too is that in order to appreciate people of substance, you have to have substance yourself.
And I think that's
you know, I mean, if you look at sort of what happens to popular culture across the course of, you know, civilizations, it tends to become more and more gaudy, more and more about spectacle and all of that sort of stuff. And I think that's the thing is that, you know, to appreciate a woman who, you know, at the age of 50, writes a book that's 1,200 pages because she's like, this is the way that cooking should be done. And the book needs to be 1,200 pages. And I'm not going to compromise on that. You in some sense have to have, you know, had to have a vision of your own that you were willing to commit that much to and to really appreciate that.
But I don't know that it's an indictment on people who don't have substance, in the sense that I think, in fact, it's a cultural shift where it's no longer sort of relevant, people think, to reach beyond themselves. Everything seems to come back to the person, yourself, the individual. It's all niche stuff that, you know, so.
But it's also,
it might, I mean, back in the day, I think, you know, I think Harper's ran an article about how the Toledo housewife, you know, she was a housewife, but she was interested in what was going on, and she read at least about what was going on in the opera scene in New York, even though she'd never been into New York.
Well, and also French cooking.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we kind of die, you know, we look now at kind of the Food Network and celebrity chefs and all of these things that we sort of take for granted. But if you dial it way back to 1960, when Mastering the Art of French Cooking came out, it was not a done deal that housewives were going to say, oh, look, 36 pages on how to make beef bourguignon, which I can't even pronounce. I'm going for it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was TV dinners, and it was, I mean, I remember my mother was a huge French chef aficionado, and in fact, it sort of killed me, because when I was really little, I was on all these sports teams, and I would come home and I would be starving, and we would not eat until 8:30 because she was deglazing and she was, you know, braising and all of sauces, and, you know, it was sort of horrible. But the point is it was not, you know, it was not just, you know, obvious that this is something, you know. But to your point, the housewife chauffeur, which is how Julia Child referred to them, and by the way, they haven't changed, still the housewife chauffeur. Housewife chauffeurs embraced, you know, this kind of whiff of the continent, this whiff of Europe, this whiff of something larger than themselves. And I know, you know, like my mom, it did give her a sense of accomplishment and a sense of pleasure. And by the way, she had to feed us anyway.
Right. Right.
You know, she had to feed us anyway. And
right.
So why not, you know, make something that you're proud of and make something sort of interesting and
well, by the way, you also are eloquent in describing or arguing for the fact that when a woman is really good in the kitchen and is an expert at creating a house, I know for me, that turns me on.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of guys in 2013. And by the way, I'm not a chauvinist. I'm just I swear to God, I'm a feminist.
I believe you.
I'm a feminist in that if you are of the same merit, then you deserve all the accolades. One of the people I admire the most, who's a friend of mine, is Ronda Rousey, who's the UFC champion. And Ronda is just such a badass, and is not about to be the girl who sits in the kitchen and cooks for you and does all that stuff. But so I look forward to her fights as much as I look forward to any guy's fight. on the planet. But having said that, there is nothing wrong with, and it's really difficult to be a great chef and to stay in shape and to have sex with your partner, and that kind of thing. The marriage is a verb, man. Marriage is a verb.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, I have to do a sidebar here, not even about Julia, but I collaborated on a book with Gabrielle Reese.
Oh, wow. I know Gabby. Yeah.
Yeah. And it came out in April. And she talks about a lot of this. She's married to, you know, big wave surfer Laird Hamilton.
Yeah, the
and, you know,
stud. The biggest stud.
The archetypal stud. Yeah.
The
right?
one I produce estrogen every time I see that guy.
I know, right?
I mean, I remember the first time, because I worked with Gabby on a TV show. And the first time I saw them walk in together before I knew her, it was at the Firehouse in Venice. I'd never seen human beings. I was just like, I want to be a fly on the wall. I wish I was invisible so I could watch them have sex.
And you were a fly on the wall.
I sure was.
I We are all flies on the wall.
Oh my God, it's so true. I was like, what happened to me? I never grew. I thought I was athletic.
No, I know. No, I was always the tall one. And I wrote this book with Gab. And so I, you know, was like the little teeny, you know, withered specimen of humanity. But anyway, she said in her book something similar. You know, she's in the female role and she provides the food and she really got a lot of grief for it. Mm. A lot of grief for saying essentially what you've just said.
But there's nothing that's a noble thing. There's a lot of power in that, by the way.
Well, also I don't quite understand if you want to be married and be in a partnership, don't you want to do make that happy? And everybody's got to eat usually three times a day, and I don't know, I'm not quite sure where all the controversy came from.
Well, tell us about these powerful women. I know Kate Hepburn had such a deep love for Spencer Tracy. I mean, she devotes an entire chapter to, I think she opens the chapter with Spencer Tracy. I loved Spencer Tracy.
She did.
And he used to drink, and he would find himself in hotel rooms, and he'd sit in a bathtub and drink himself to you know, oblivion over 3 days, and she would find him.
And a lot of the reasons he still continued to get cast is because the studios knew that she came with him. That she would make sure that he was sober and he would show up on the set.
That's right. And she used to sleep at the foot of his bed and just nurse him back to health. That's one of the most romantic chapters and things I've ever read in my life, man. I had such a, I mean, and you want to talk about a badass, Katharine Hepburn. I mean, I just see her with a shotgun on her porch, ready to take on all comers.
Whether it's the African Queen. I mean, there's a great story about when she was the African Queen and they were in Botswana or Congo or wherever they were, and the costume department for the movie consisted of Katharine Hepburn carrying the full-length mirror under her arm and propping it against a tree. That was
amazing.
But
she was a real discipline. Yeah. Well, tell us about. I'm sorry that I went off on that, but tell us about these women and how they for listeners and what their philosophy was on all things man and woman and how they navigated their relationships.
Well, you know, like all human beings, it wasn't easy, and it wasn't a slam dunk.
Right.
You know, one thing that has been pointed out to me is that none of these women had children, which, of course, makes their lives different than many, many of the lives of, you know, my readers. But I think it was complicated. I think, you know, I mean, Coco Chanel was French, and that kind of puts her... Like, she was all about, like, nobody was more badass than Coco Chanel, but she was all about, like, oh, the man and the woman, and I'm sort of the little, you know, little lady. But, you know, she didn't, I mean, she would give lip service to that, but she didn't really act like that. And maybe perhaps, you know, that's the French way, but she did talk about it a lot. You know, Georgia O'Keeffe had an incredibly complicated and mutually beneficial relationship with Alfred Stieglitz.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, not necessarily a happy marriage, but I'll tell you one thing. You know, O'Keeffe was so far ahead of her time. She was like on Mars. I mean, she was a completely different beast than Julia Child. But Stieglitz really saw her as she wanted to be seen.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I think,
because I've always said that men... Well, I always tell women, I say this in my stand-up, I say, look, men want to be admired. They just want to be admired. I think they're looking for their mother. Their mother looks at them when they're the minute they come out with the biggest, most adoring eyes. And if I don't care, I always talk about dick size. I get silly, but I mean, if the guy has a mushroom cap and you love him, act like it's the biggest thing you've ever
seen.
Because that make a lot of noise in bed. We don't want to hear you laughing. We don't want to hear you go, aw. I want to hear you catching your breath. I can't take it. It's too much. Listen, that's how guys are, and none of us are immune to it, you know? I do this joke where I say I dated a girl for a long time. I couldn't break up with her because she sounded like she was falling out of a building when we and she was Cuban. I couldn't get enough of it. I was like, I'm a hero. I can't break up with this girl.
That's why you put up with women who, by the way, are sometimes extremely difficult to put up with.
Oh my God, are you kidding? I move them into my house. I don't care if they have track marks and a bat tattooed to their face. I'll pay all their bills. I'll date them for at least 2 years.
It's true. And by the way, getting back to Julia Child.
Yeah.
You know, she and Paul had, you know, one of the most successful and admired marriages of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, you know, on paper they didn't look like they went together.
Yeah.
But
that's
when
true.
They hooked up, they were a team like no other. I mean, one of the things that's kind of extraordinary is that before The French Chef, you know, he was in the Foreign Service, and she would sort of move around from place to place to place, to Paris, to Marseille, somewhere in Germany, you know, and she was like the wife, and she would cook, and she would entertain, you know, traveling dignitaries and all that, and the second her star rose, he became the wife.
Wow. Mm. Yeah, that says a lot about him.
And, you know, I mean, I don't think it was completely without bumps. I'm not trying to suggest that he was like, oh, sure, honey, now you're the man and I'm the woman. But but it was, they were such a team.
I think sometimes, you know, that I dated Fiona Apple for a little while. And I remember realizing very quickly that Fiona was just a better artist than I was. Like, she was just clearly was on a level artistically as a songwriter, just as a painter and as a human being. That I really believe in a lot of ways she was just a better person. I had no problem just being in a position of total admiration. I almost felt like my ego's way too big, by the way, and I'm just too much of a type A personality. But I can see, even for someone like me, I can see kind of taking a back seat and kind of letting this creature shine, you know, when you're with a force of nature. And yeah. Julia Child was. I like the way you describe how sort of, you know, she would rage and she would cry and she would throw, you know, she was so human.
Yeah.
You know, yet she was able to accomplish all this stuff. Yet she had a profound influence on American culture.
And the other, you know, the thing that I say in the book that I think it comes down to it, and, you know, I'm not sure, and I'd be interested to hear if guys kind of feel the same way, but Julia was not a woman divided against herself. And I think when you're a human being and you are not divided against yourself, when you're not saying, I'm doing this, but I should be doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, look. Oh, I made a mistake. You know, that if you're just moving forward with the force of your passion and personality, that you can really accomplish great things. And like I said, to me, being female, I see a lot of women that are always just sort of questioning everything that's going on, and it hamper, you know, you hamper yourself that way.
Well, that you're speaking my religion now. And I one of the things that my wife and I had a long talk about, and it was, I said, you know, I have a passion. You've got to find the passion. She found horseback riding.
Oh, we're a horse family. So.
It's amazing. And when it was so important for our relationship, because even though she's gone 4 hours of the day, and you know, if it costs a fortune, my business manager was
like having a yacht.
Oh, my business manager was like, you're leasing a horse? What are you, a land baron now? And I said to him, I said, I'll do whatever it takes to afford that horse, because it's a huge part of why, you know, it keeps our marriage dynamic, because because now she can speak my language. When you're trying to get better at something, you hit plateaus, you have peaks, you have valleys. There is common ground there, because she has a passion, I have a passion, and we can meet in the middle. And that's really important, man.
Well, and I think that, you know, that's the other thing too, is that, you know, I think all of us can currently in the culture sort of throw around this word passion, And there's somewhat of an assumption that what you're passionate about, you also have an aptitude for.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that's kind of wonderful about Julia is that, you know, she found cooking and she fell in love with it, but she you know, at the end of the day, she didn't have any natural talent.
That's right.
Her love of it, and she allowed herself to make mistakes, a lot of them. And, you know, it's almost comical.
Well, you say her favorite hors d'oeuvre was Pepperidge Farm goldfish.
And I think it was because, well, I don't know. People ask me why. Like, I have some, you know, I don't know why. I think it was because, you know, she was always sort of focusing on the meal. I mean, she also bought a lot of store-bought desserts, too.
Amazing.
So I think actually the meal kind of in the, you know, was really her focus. And she also, you know, especially when she lived in Cambridge, she invited a lot of people in the neighborhood to come over and cook. And it was a very communal activity. And I think, you know, maybe just tossing out the goldfish was sort of an easier way to focus on the meal. Or
well, you know, you
yeah, history.
but there, it also speaks to another thing, and I thought you it was really I love this about. First of all, I read your blog about, I think it was your blog about how you go about writing, and you're like talking about how you're paralyzed, but because you're writing the greatest novel ever. In fact, Jonathan Franzen is going to be like, what am I doing on the cover of Time magazine?
He's going to come and be so embarrassed.
I love that so much, because that's exactly how I feel every time I try to write a script or something. But
right, isn't it like, oh, this is it?
Yes, of course. I'm gonna, by the way, I don't know where I'm gonna put my Oscar, but
all your Oscars.
Well, I'm actually having shelves made now. but you talk about Juliet Child, who was not, you know, her motto was, you know, I think she said something to the effect of less learning and more moonshine.
Yeah.
And you know, she really didn't know what she was getting herself into. She kind of just would go, and it would appear. Talk about that a little bit, because you've learned how to do that as a writer, and Julia Child did that. She just found, she didn't think about it too much. She just did it and figured her way through. Now, obviously, writing is a craft. You want to outline and stuff like that. You don't want to just start writing, but... But talk
a little
bit about
that. Well, I
think, you
know, the important thing, and, you know, I also teach writing, and so, you know, it's dialing it back to where it becomes fun and engaging for you.
Mm.
So, you know, for some people, they can still say, oh, this book is going to be great, and it doesn't hamper them. Some people, you know, you have to say, look, if these three paragraphs that I write today make any kind of sense in the English language, then I have done my job. And if that reduces the anxiety and reduces your attachment to the outcome, then that's good. So, I think that Julia was always, even though she was working on this massive cookbook, you know, she was always just, and it's one of the rules in the book, is solve the problem in front of you. You know, how do I make this mayonnaise not curdle?
I had a thought. You write this series on Kick-Ass Women, and to that point, I thought to myself, if all these women sat down to have dinner, I bet you Julia Child would be the one cooking, and she probably wouldn't be engaged in the conversation, say, between Kate Hepburn, George O'Keefe, and Coco Chanel. I think those three would have probably either fierce arguments or have an amazing time. What do you think a dinner would be like with the four of them?
You know, I have actually thought about this more than you might imagine. and, you know, I think it would not actually be a happy time. You know, they were all they were incredibly opinionated. You guys have to, if you get a minute, and I know I'm sure you have copious amounts of free time, but there's a Dick Cavett interview with Katharine Hepburn that is just, she was scheduled to go on his show, and instead she came the day before to check out the set to see if she was going to say yes or no.
Yep.
And Dick Cavett happened to stop by. I mean, literally, he's like on the way to his boat, and he's wearing like white pants and white deck shoes, and she says, okay, let's do it now.
Yeah.
And there was a cameraman on hand, and they did it, and she is so judgmental, and, you know, Dick Cavett is so funny, and
I saw the interview.
The furniture, and the rug, and I just think if all four of them sat down, that they would, the degree to which they could not find common ground would make your head spin.
Wow. So Coco would be judging Catherine's slacks.
Well, yeah, you know that, I mean.
And Julia Child's cooking, Julia Child's cooking, you know, because she's French, and she'd be like, how dare this American try to cook?
Well, absolutely. And yeah. Coco Chanel also said, I mean, she was not in any way a foodie. She said, I eat standing up like a racehorse. So Coco, even though
wow.
she like, yeah, so she was like all about her work.
Yeah. But none of them had children. I wonder if there was regret for that.
Well, you know, there's different thinking. I mean, Giorgio wanted kids. Stieglitz already had a daughter with whom he enjoyed a very complicated and difficult relationship, and he was 24 years older, so he wasn't in for that. Julia and Paul wanted children. Well, actually, Julia wanted children, and it just didn't work out. And, you know, in those days, you either adopted or you just lived with your fate. So she did. And in fact, she never really talked much about it, except for when she was, I think, in her 90s. And she mentioned to a friend that it would have been nice, you know, to have had a grandchild or two in her deep old age. But really, she felt sad about it. There's actually a lovely little scene in Julie and Julia where Meryl Streep, as Julia Child, finds out that her sister Dort is pregnant, and she cries a little, and Paul holds her. And I think that was probably an accurate representation. You know, I think she did feel very sad, but life rolled on, and she was always going to be in the center of life. So
right.
Yeah.
Who is the woman in that group that you think you'd like to have dinner with? Before anybody else, and you've written books about these women. Who did you find that you admire the most?
Well, you know, I mean, I have to say, you know, I look at Georgia O'Keeffe, and she was so aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but, you know, she was an artistic genius, and I think anytime you look at a genius,
yeah.
it's like you're really looking at someone on the other side of, you know, the room. I mean, it's like, you are awesome out there, but... So, and you know, a difficult person. I mean, you know, I had actually wanted to write Julia Child Rules right after the Katharine Hepburn book, but my publisher pointed out that was right when Julie and Julia was in production. And so it was like, I think we have enough Julia Child out there. So the thing about Julia is that she really was every woman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you look at, you know, Katharine Hepburn, you know, for whatever her acting talents were, photographed exquisitely. That bone structure,
yeah,
you're
amazing.
Just like born
yeah.
with it. So forget that. Coco Chanel, you know, had this epic rags to riches story and happened to be born at a time when, you know, she caught a lot of breaks, and she had an exquisite taste and, again, a sort of genius.
Yeah.
But Julia Child was like all of us, you know, didn't find her métier until she was in her late 30s. Really had a lot of like, and you know, it's so funny because we talk now about a lot of, you know, youngins in their 20s and like failure to launch and what's going on. And that was totally Julia.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. You know,
late
she was
bloomer.
A really crappy student at Smith. She liked to party. That was, you know, the only thing that inspired her to get her grades up is that if when you were a senior, you had a BA average, you could have a car.
That's great.
And she got her car, and she
great.
Took everybody to speakeasy.
She was a bit of a hedonist, I guess. You know?
A total hedonist.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is why it's so interesting that she became obsessed with French cooking, which is so demanding and
mm-hmm.
disciplined, and it has, you know, such a history. And
I love cooking and sex, but I'm just a lot more muscular and a lot leaner than she was. And I just want to throw that out there, Karen. Keep going. It's not about
well,
me.
You know,
it's not about me.
She wanted. Julia loved men in the kitchen, like. She, you know, when she became older and sort of there were all these like young dude chefs coming up,
yeah,
she was friends with them all, she mentored them all, and she really wanted, you know, cooking to be sort of more of an equal opportunity activity.
Right.
So she would have liked Tony Bourdain and so forth. She would just love it all.
I love Bourdain. Well, I guess the great chefs were always men, at least in France.
Yeah, and you know what they say? Huh. The great chefs were always men, and they had a grandma back in the village where they got all their recipes from.
That is exactly right, by the way. I've talked to great chefs
right?
In New York and L.A., and they all say that. They all say, well, I had a mother that, or I had a grandmother. That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Right,
total sense.
Yeah, no, and, you know, Julia, I mean, not everybody loved, like, we love Julia. Not everyone loved Julia.
Mm.
people, you know, even in this country, said, you know, she's not French, she's not a chef.
Yeah.
Why does a housewife need to learn to cook haute cuisine? You know, that her, she had a very populist streak.
Yeah.
And not everyone thought that was cool, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. But she really was.
Well, she also had... You know, if you were to choose someone, I can just see the auditions today in these reality shows where they're looking for the next Iron Chef. And you had a woman who spoke this way the whole time. I doubt that she would have made it. I mean, there's no way that they would have chosen her. You know, she was kind of like she kind of defied all odds in that sense.
Well, and I think too, you know, it's, and if you look at where we are and how sort of, you know, self-conscious, self-promoting, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, when she was on TV, like, she and Paul didn't even have a TV.
I know.
Yeah. You know, when they said, oh, come and be on this TV show, they were like, well, this is a weird thing. Okay, now I have to, like, move, cook, mm-hmm. look in the camera. I mean, it was a skill set that she was just very engaged in mastering. But
yeah, she would rehearse
of,
with her husband the night before, right?
Yep, for hours. They would stay up way late. And, you know, if you go back and look at the early French chef, the mistakes that she would make on camera, and because it was a single take, it's crazy, but it's also instructive because it's part of what we really dug about her.
Yeah. Well, and there are those...
Part of what gave people the courage to cook is that, oh, look, I burnt this. Oh, well, it gives a nice effect. We'll just move this to the side. Not to worry. And I think that was really... inadvertently what made people fall in love with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like it's kind of like watching,
so human.
Yeah, it's kind of like watching race car, you know, races and people, they say people go to NASCAR to see a crash, not to see somebody win.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's kind of more
burn the French onion soup. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, the outrage. It's so exciting. Look at that. Look at that smoke. She's toasted the cheese.
And like I said, when I was researching the book, I watched them over and over again, and some of the malaprops and the misspeakings and you know, also just the technologically how hilarious it is. One time those cameras like panning across, and I don't know what happened with the cameraman, but the camera suddenly flipped up and looking at the ceiling.
Oh,
and
God.
Then it's like, oh, whoops, and then it tries to find focus again. It's just hugely
entertaining. Well, what's your take on Martha Stewart?
Martha's like historically.
Well, I mean, I don't know. She strikes me as probably someone who's very ambitious. The opposite of Julia Child in the sense that she seemed very calculated, very ambitious, maybe a bit of a narcissist, and not the warmest character if you actually look at the way she behaves.
Right. Well, you know, I think, you know, and this, Martha couldn't have been Martha without Julia, right?
Yep.
So, you know, I look at someone who had these kind of domestic skills, which, you know, I do have to hand it to her. She found a way to leverage these domestic skills at a time when, you know, in the 80s, we were kind of, the pendulum was sort of on the other side, right? Women were going to work. They were wearing their power suits.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, she, but that said, the kind of, the rampant sort of careerism it is very evident.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, I don't mean to knock it, and maybe I was a little unfair in my characterization, but not somebody you'd want to write a book about because she came along, she didn't have the same impact, is what you're saying.
Well, she did. I mean, like I said, she, you know, you got to hand her success to her because she really, you know, created this empire sort of out of nothing, and I'm always, you know, enamored of that, and I always admire that. Mm. But, you know, Julia was very clear. You know, she wrote these books. She stayed with WGBH, the educational station in Boston, long after she got offers from the networks, because she said, "I am an educator, and I'm throwing my lot in with the educators." So she
had
talking
Martha Stewart was?
No, Julia.
So Julia had a very clear mission and a very clear sense of herself as a cooking teacher.
Mm.
So when you think of a teacher, you think of, you know, I am, it's about other people.
Yeah.
you know, yes, okay, so Martha Stewart, you're making a beautiful table and this very fussy cake, and but it's kind of about presentation. It's not really about giving you the tools to make your life better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think the other interesting thing is, you know, all of these kick-ass women books are really about lessons on living, right?
Yeah.
There's so many books that are about succeeding in your career or mastering something or anything like that. And, you know, I think what's so great about these books is they're really about how to have a great life. And I think that's also the real...
Which is relevant for men, by the way.
Absolutely.
That's the thing. You
that's
know?
A universal. And I think that's, you know, for example, you know, as an educator, you know, Julia's decision to remain an educator, that's may not produce the most money in the world, but it
right.
does provide a much more satisfying way to live.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the other thing, Hunter. That's actually a great point. And I was, you know, I'm always reminded in working on these books, you know, that we all live the 24 hours of our days. And I think especially, you know, because these women, you know, became not just celebrities but also icons that we still have, you know, attachment to, mm-hmm. how they lived those 24 hours, whether things were going well for them, whether things were frustrating for them, you know, like all humans, they suffered a lot of setbacks, they suffered disappointment, people died, people got sick, things didn't go the way they thought they were going to go, and yet they still managed to be in their lives, be in the moment, make the best of it, get through it.
Did they all die fabulously wealthy?
No.
They didn't?
No.
Mm.
No. You know, Coco Chanel, who you would think would be the richest, actually was not that rich. Most of her money came from the perfume side of things.
Right.
And at the very, very end of her life, when she launched her last few lines of clothing, it was financed by the perfume company, which she did not own a majority share in. So,
wow.
Yeah, so she, you know, so not fabulously rich. O'Keefe had a good amount, but there was the matter of Juan Hamilton, a young man who came into her life when she was very, very old and who took care of her, and there was some finagling with the will.
Always a guy named Juan. Always a guy named
Juan.
I was going to say,
I don't really talk too much about that in the book. You know, because of what these books are, you know, what Juan did for her at the end of her life was basically she was going blind, which is such an irony for George O'Keefe. And he basically allowed her to kind of participate in her life and the world longer than she would have become a shut-in. So, you know, nobody's in anybody else's relationship, as I like to say, but there was some funny business with money at the end.
Right,
with Juan, yeah.
And what about Julia?
You know, she, because she had no heirs, she set up the Julia Child Foundation.
Mm.
And I think she she came from a lot of money in Pasadena, California.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She did. She, her father was one of sort of the early land barons.
Oh, boy.
In Pasadena and had money in the Owens Valley. And
Kind of like Brian, a land baron with horses.
I was going to say.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, in fact,
and, you know,
yeah.
They she had some money and she was frugal, but she did spend a lot of money on food and on cooking utensils and pots and pans and so forth. But she was pretty frugal, so I think she probably ended up okay.
Right.
Financially.
And what were these women? What was their nationality? Child sounds Irish. O'Keefe sounds Irish or Scottish.
Well, we know Katharine Hepburn was WASP.
Yep.
WASPy.
She's WASP, as WASPy as it gets.
WASPy. And then, well, Coco was obviously French, but she was from, her people were from the Auvergne, which is, you know, in every country there's places in the country where, like, sort of the snootier folks look down on them.
Yeah.
And the Auvergne is sort of considered to be backwards and country.
Of course, peasants, Auvergne.
Exactly. So, but that was her. And then Georgia O'Keefe was Irish and Hungarian.
Oh, okay.
And then Julia, yeah, was, I think, Scottish and English and, you know, pretty much standard. That's sort of standard early 20th century Western European fare. So
yeah.
Who else would you want to, if you had to choose four more kick-ass
oh my
women
God.
To write about? I know. See, I'm full of questions, baby.
Well, you know,
I mean, how about a stand-up comic slash sometimes working actor?
That is a dream come true.
That's
Brian.
What I'm talking about. I want you just following me around taking notes.
You know, actually, it's funny because you know, now the first one of these books came out in 2007, and so as I sort of traveled the land, and you know, every once in a while, men will come up to me, and almost I think this has happened 3 times, which feels like a lot. They'll say, "How about Gary Cooper?" Like. All the dudes want me to do Gary Cooper.
Gary Cooper.
I don't know what that means.
What, were you in a time portal?
No. They come up and say, Gary Cooper.
Gary Cooper, you want a soda pop with that kid?
I know. And, you know, and I actually keep meaning to look up, like, is there some secret that men know about Gary Cooper that
no.
I don't know?
No, they want you to find it out.
Yeah. Man, but then again, a lot of men have been written about. A lot of the greats, you know, whether it's Muhammad Ali, you know, you go, there are a lot of books written about. You know, that market's pretty saturated.
Well, and there's that really great book that Pete Hamill wrote called Why Sinatra Matters.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, you totally, if you haven't looked at it, it's very much sort of in the vein of the kick-ass women books. It's like, here was this iconic guy, he wasn't perfect, you know, his phrasing and the way that he interpreted music changed the whole face of 20th century music.
Mm-hmm.
He was a jerk, he was great, this is why he matters to us.
Yeah.
It's really
a
wonderful little book.
I never understood what made him, I know he's great and all that as far as his voice and stuff, but people use the expression phrasing, never understood what it even meant, you know, with Sinatra, but whatever.
If I was a singer, I would right now, like, sing you what I mean, but I think it
I'd be like, there it is.
I'm going to have to get that worked up for my act. But
I love it. Where do you teach writing?
You know, I teach usually in the summer. There's I'm coming to you from Portland, Oregon right now. There's a summer workshop at Reed College called the Tin House Writers Workshop.
I just did stand-up in Portland. I love that town.
Oh, yeah, thank you. And I do, you know, occasionally, like I do some MFA intensives around universities around about. But mostly I try and support myself with my writing.
Yeah.
So,
and you do a good job of it. I'll tell you that much.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Good writer. Well, what's next? What's the next book?
Well, you asked me about who I might. You know, I always think every kick-ass woman book is the last one because it was just the Katharine Hepburn book, and then my editor said, well, there's certainly, you know, who else. And so I thought, well, who else? And so, you know, it sort of is just being put together. It's like a house that doesn't have any architectural drawings. It's just you keep adding on one room and then another room.
Yeah, yeah. But before you answer who, how has it changed your life? When you write about these women, you're kind of taking these steps yourself, aren't you? It's hard not to have, when you research these women, it's hard not to have them influence, you know, the way, at least for me, it'd be hard not to have them influence the way I walk and talk and speak and philosophize and all that stuff, right?
One tries. It's amazing how much you're not able to absorb the wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, you you kind of put it out there. But I do come back and you know, like, you know, one of the Julia Child rules, solve the problem in front of you. Another rule is to be happy, work hard. And, you know, that's part of that not being attached to the outcome, is that if you like your work,
mm-hmm.
that you really are happy there. I mean, one of the things, too, and this is true for all these women, they were not so concerned and obsessed as we are with happiness.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, like,
talk
we are, like,
that.
Aiming straight on, like, happy, happy, am I happy, happy? And, you know, happiness really is a side effect of living a meaningful life.
Mm. I love that.
Yeah. You know, so none of that. So you know, they achieved happiness. I think it was because they had found work that suited them, and you know, they were able to engage in it fully.
So the pursuit of happiness comes not from pursuing happiness, but from pursuing meaning.
No, yeah, pursuing meaning.
It's amazing how much we talk about happiness. It's amazing how many people I know who, until she really confronts this issue, she's never really going to be happy. She's got to go through therapy. She's doing a lot of work on herself. Would you shut up? We're sitting here drinking wine, man, eating a good meal. Take a fucking load off and relax. You know, I can't stand it. It drives me crazy.
Yeah,
I'm happy right now. I'll take this moment, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, don't even get into, like, you know, we have running water. my legs work.
Oh, we have
I
antibiotics.
I put food in on one end, and it comes out the other.
Exactly.
I mean, like, all the stuff you should be really happy about.
I agree. You know? I agree. We have antibiotics. We have representative government. Now shut up. You're not
you
in
know,
North Korea.
It's kind of true. Exactly. We're not in Syria, by the way.
By the way, yeah.
To completely bring the conversation down. But, yeah. So I think the point is, and, you know, I'm not the first, obviously, to say this. I think, in fact, Thomas Jefferson may have said it. You know, it's
but
that
you,
really
But you
happiness.
Remind me. You remind me a lot of TJ, so keep going.
That's me, yeah.
Yeah, a lot better looking, but still, keep going.
Hey, thanks. Mm-hmm. But really, that happiness, you know, you just realize one day that you're happy.
Yeah.
You know, you're not aiming at it. It's like you're doing your thing, and you're like, hey, this is pretty great.
I actually like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you think about how the Founding Fathers phrased that, think about how general that is. Life, you're entitled to life, whatever that means, liberty, and you are and the pursuit, not happiness, but the pursuit of happiness.
Exactly.
That's very telling, isn't it? You know, the fact that it's a verb. You're always reaching for this thing. And by the way, I think the fun is in the reach, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's something I sort of talk about in the Coco Chanel book is that, you know, she reached such heights. I mean, at one point she was like the richest woman in France, and the only guy she could date was the Duke of Westminster, was the richest guy in the world. I mean, you know, and was she more happier when she was not necessarily happier when she was up there.
Right.
When she was creating something new, when she was really absorbed in her work and making things because she was a maker, she was happy.
You know, Hunter and I talk about, and I give Hunter a lot of credit for this, or maybe all the credit. You know, Hunter's an educator and one of the smartest guys I know. And Hunter said, listen, you know, this podcast, we could have a lot of actors and comedians on. The problem is you run out of things to say. And
well,
Hunter
yeah.
said, why don't we get a bunch of really smart people who write books, who are doing nothing but writing books, and they want to talk about their work because nobody reads anymore in this world. And,
yeah.
And this is the kind of stuff, like having a conversation with someone like you, who's taken the time to think about this stuff and illuminate us on people that we wouldn't know about, and like Julia Child and stuff. This is what enriches, and whether or not we get 500,000 listeners or not, it's just not that important to me. You know, we were talking about this. You make a choice just to do what interests you and what moves you, and then the rest kind of takes care of itself.
Well, it's completely true, and I wanted to mention I'm doing, as a part of the book publishing, I'm doing this blog project.
Mm-hmm.
Which is called Live Like Julia, and I've reached out to bloggers, really, and it's turning out to be all across the world, saying, here's the 10 rules, pick one, live it a week, and then blog about it. And people, it's just astonishing what some woman in Italy is living with abandon. And I already said, you know, you already live in Italy. Like,
yeah.
Isn't that
yeah.
kind of...
yeah, I know.
There are 9 other rules that perhaps will obtain more, like to work, be happy, to be happy, work. But the point is, I guess, is, you know, I have no idea whether this means more people are going to buy the book or whatever, you know, the ultimate goal is.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I think these books make great gifts. If you're a guy out there and you want to impress your gal,
load up, guys.
They should load up. They should get these four books.
Get the four set.
And tie them in a ribbon and go, you know what? These are real kick-ass women, and you remind me of one of these women. And you should check out Karen. You should check out Karen Carbo's blog, because the way you got rule number one, live with a band, and rule number two, play the emperor. Rule number three, learn to be amused. Rule number four, obey your whims. Rule number five, all you need is a kitchen and a bedroom. My favorite, by the way. I read that twice. Sent it to my wife. And rule
it's
number
so
six,
true.
Be happy and work hard. That's all you need.
Did you see in the blog, like, if you can't do the bedroom, make a pie? Because a pie is almost sex.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And you have recipes for the pie, man. You go, it may not be sex, but it's almost sex. Yeah, I don't even, listen, I'll show you my torso. I don't eat carbs. I'm shredded. But the point is, you made me want pie, for God's sake.
And Brian, your skin looks really tight right
Thank
now.
Thank you, buddy. That's why they call me Brian the Kid Callen.
That's all that natural light in there, right?
That's exactly right.
That's right.
It's also shadowing. Karen, you're a joy. This has been a blast, and you know, I think we solved all the world's problems.
You know what? And our work is done here, as we said at the beginning.
That's exactly right. When I'm back in Portland, you got to come out. I'll get you a front row seat, and you can...
Absolutely. I would love it, Brian. And yeah, let me know, and I'll bring my crew.
That's what I'm talking about, a bunch of just intellectual...
My kick-ass crew.
Yeah, just a bunch of intellectual women who write. I love it.
So those are the groupies you want, right?
That's exactly right. So you can judge my
that's
how
right.
thematic.
We'll sit in the front row with our arms crossed.
Exactly. you can judge how thematic I am. Oh God, that's just what I need. I love it. Karen Carbo, thank you so much. And Hunter Motz, thank you for hipping me to a very hip woman.
My pleasure.
There it is.
Thanks, everybody.
I'll see you later, man.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you.
That was great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Another great interview. Thank you to Hunter Motz once again finding these people. I don't know how you find everybody like this. It's unbelievable. He's like, you know what? It's a little bit of a sausage fest on the BCS. We need to turn it into
a clam bake.
Exactly. Sir, you went to Harvard. Sir, I beg your pardon, sir. This is the Brian. This is a. I used the F word. I got so excited. I guess I'm going to do my Hustler interview now. Is that what I'm doing? I don't know.
Yeah, at
1
o'clock.
At 1 o'clock. What time is it now? I got an hour.
11:52.
Got an hour to go get some chili or something. Got an hour to go bake a fucking pie.
Pie, that's right.
Yeah. Once again, for anybody listening, I always have a feeling like 6 people are listening. I don't know who the hell's listening to this, but let's see. What are my dates? Donnie B's. Something about Donnie B's. Donnie B's, I'll be in Springfield, Illinois at Donnie B's. That just sounds depressing, but I'm sure it's a great club. October 4th and 5th, and then I'll be October 11th, 12th, and 13th, I'll be at the Houston Improv, and the 17th, 18th, 19th, I'll be at Helium in Buffalo, and then I'll be in Calgary the 24th, 25th, 26th. Just go to briancallen.com.
And KarenCarbo.com.
She's got, I love the blogs.
The blog is, I think it's really excellent.
Yeah, guys should actually read it. There's probably one woman who listens to this. But guys should read it.
And it's Rena, the sound engineer.
And she's right there. All right, guys, thanks very much. Anna's been snapping photos of us for Hustler magazine, so I'm finally going to be in Hustler.
Every man's dream.
I know. I even opened my legs at one point, but I'm wearing jeans. Peace!
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.